the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, supported by great listeners, including Susan Super. I didn't make that up. Marilyn Ryan, Rita Sheldrake, and Linda Gray. I appreciate your financial support, and if you're able to extend that, go to my website, peterbcollins.com. The links are on the right-hand side of the homepage, and our voluntary subscriptions start at just $5 a month. I've just returned from almost 2 weeks away, and I'll disclose to you that I was on the island of Maui in Hawaii, and I was largely unplugged from the media. I did get some email, and I kept up with the news a little bit, but I watched zero television, read only one newspaper, and despite my self-imposed unplug or blackout move, I was aware that the Senate was debating and ultimately passed, on the 1st of December, a very troubling bill. And this is a bill that... It really cements aspects of the creeping police state that I have been talking about for several years and that you've heard us discuss with Sibel Edmonds in our Boiling Frogs interview series. On today's program, we have two guests. In our second segment, Susan Lindauer returns. She's an American citizen who was working as an informant for the CIA prior to the invasion of Iraq. And she wound up being detained without charge at an Air Force base called Carswell for almost a year. And she wrote a book about it, and we interviewed her over a year ago. Her book is called Extreme Prejudice. She'll join us in our second segment. But to explain some of the details and concerns about the passage of the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2012, Colleen Rowley returns to our program. She worked as an FBI agent for many years, and we know her as one of the people who tried to warn headquarters in Washington about the so-called 20th hijacker named Moussaoui, who was trying to attend a flight school in the Minneapolis area, and Colleen served in the Minneapolis FBI office. And she's been on our program before, also with Sibel on the Boiling Frogs. Colleen Rowley, welcome back.
Hi.
It's good to talk with you again. And you've written a piece that has been widely published on the web. I picked it up at consortiumnews.com. I think it originated at Huffington Post. And I'm going to link your article to this podcast so that people can easily find it. But you have serious concerns about elements of this new defense appropriation bill. If you could, illuminate us with what you think the most egregious elements are.
Well, let me say first, I'm not the only one with serious concerns. This bill is deliberately confusing, and the media did basically mention that the Senate had passed this, but it was on page 5 in this little paragraph. And the media is confused, and commentators are confused. But the worst draconian interpretations of this, and I think that the bill. There's one area that is controversial, and it's, you would hope that the Supreme Court would overturn it at some point, 12 years down the road, maybe, if a case made its way, which is really the one that people in the United States care about, which is that it would allow a warrantless due process detention, indefinite detention, just as we've done in Guantanamo, of American citizens in the United States. And there's one, the reason it's confusing is because this thing's pages long, and there's one other sentence in the there's one other sentence in there that says it doesn't apply to American citizens.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, the language is written in a way that it would, and Dianne Feinstein, who's no slouch about reading legislation, actually said, well, let's make it clear that it doesn't apply to American citizens, and she called for a separate vote, which failed, 45 to 55. And so if you read my Huffington Post, you'll see people saying, don't worry about this, it doesn't apply to American citizens. But of course, when there's a vote in the Senate and it fails by 10 votes, that it doesn't apply, of course you should be concerned. And there are other commentators are saying that in a way this legalizes de facto practices already of course, warrantless and due process free civil liberties violations. But here's what the three things are that this bill would do. The one is it would extend the 2001 authorization to use military force. A lot of people had thought since we got Osama bin Laden and there's down to less than 100 al-Qaeda that this would be the perfect time now to say the war is over and this authorization has expired from 2001. Longest war on record. There was a lot of pressure. Well, this bill now, a funding bill, which is hard to veto in and of itself because it's a defense funding bill, basically not only extends the authorization, but it delinks it from 9/11. So no longer do you even have to prove a nexus to al-Qaeda or the 9/11 attacks. It's got some words in there about it can be I'll just read it. It says it would renew the 2001 authorization to use military force with more expansive language to allow force military detention against not only those who perpetrated the 9/11 attacks and countries which harbored them, but also anyone who substantially supports al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces.
Wow. How broad can that be? I mean, that's just amazing. You can drive several Mack trucks through that.
Yes, and you know, we've been hearing by many of these militants, sometimes they kind of mess up, and they actually say that this is a long war. There have been some of the generals and stuff that we say that it's expected to go on for 50 to 80 years. And as soon as we kind of do whack-a-mole, and you're in one country for a while, and then you switch over to other countries. So this has been, obviously, the strategic plan. This law is a very kind of sly way of now putting it into law so that now, and of course the problem is many people haven't even read this carefully.
Mm-hmm. And Colleen, I want to take these one by one. There are three key egregious elements of this new defense authorization bill. So when we talk about the post 9/11, it was passed on September 13th of 2001, the AUMF, authorization for the use of military force. There was a single no vote in the House against it. Barbara Lee, a congresswoman I respect from across the bay in Oakland. And over the past year, she's made several attempts to introduce legislation to repeal that AUMF. And she was moving in the right direction, but clearly the sense of the Republican majority in the House and the split Senate, which includes many Democrats, including Carl Levin and Senator Leahy from Vermont, who have voted for this new bill, it is extremely troubling that we really are making permanent this state of war and expanding the permissible targets. And this is what allows us to conduct drone strikes in Yemen, even against an American citizen like Anwar al-Awlaki, even against his teenage children, who were not identified and placed on this list of kill or capture individuals. And so this really does permit the president and his successors to wage war either on an individual using a drone strike or on a nation without any further authorization from Congress. This is deeply troubling.
Right. It basically is the long war and indefinite war. And it, of course, completely undermines the need for congressional authorization. But, of course, de facto, that has already occurred with Libya.
You're right.
And I think even Barbara Lee went along with Libya, or she, you know, where they're using this humanitarian pretext that we're helping the people by bombing them. And so it's really, really sinister and really seductive that the long war now on terrorism will expand.
And if I may, just to be clear, I believe Barbara Lee supported the president but did call for a vote of Congress. She kind of split the baby on Libya.
Oh, good. That's good, because it gets so depressing to see how politics works, and over time people, you know, it is sad to see how many people seem to have lost their integrity over this whole long decade now.
Well, you're right, because many of the people who were very vocal when George Bush was expanding presidential power have gone silent, as Barack Obama has grabbed even more executive authority.
That's right. It's the two-party system, kind of a ping-pong, and people don't, you know, again, they're superficially loyal to their party, so they don't really look at the policies. I'll just mention one more thing. The authorization to use military force, there was an attempt in the Senate along just about the same day as this passed, or the day before, by Rand Paul. And I think there were 30-some in the Senate that actually voted with him that this should be ended. So this is where the pressure is coming, and this is obviously why they've put it into this NDAA, which is now very difficult to veto because it's defense funding and because it passed, ultimately passed 93-7. And, you know, if you look at that, that would, of course, override. That'd be enough votes to override a presidential veto.
Yes, it is on the face of it. Now, when we talk about this authorization for the use of military force, is there any sense in the, you know, the minds of the people who voted for this that we need checks and balances? Or have they simply, you know, ignored the Constitution and said that the exigencies of our current situation, which I think are highly exaggerated, require this? And who cares about the Constitution? We've got to be safe.
I'll differ a little bit. I think they have completely abdicated their response. The Congress has completely abdicated its responsibility, and this preceded this bill. You know, the whole last decade, they have allowed the president, of course, under Bush, but also under Obama, to have these emergency war powers. When John Yoo was kind of the architect of this unitary executive power that, you know, in it's wartime, so that as long as the war goes on, we will let the president make all these calls, even to launching new war. And I mean, essentially, the Congress is just, and I think they don't, it's not because they're concerned that they need decisive action. I don't think that is at all the reason. I think it's just difficult politically. They don't want to be seen as weak on terror, and they prefer that the executive take the heat for these decisions one way or the other. So I think that they've simply chosen the easy way out by abdicating their responsibility and power. This bill, though, is now being criticized by the Obama administration, FBI director, CIA director, National Intelligence Director, and even the Department of Defense Secretary have all advised Obama against this bill because it curtails his discretion in a couple of other ways with respect to Guantanamo.
Now, before we go to the next point, though, Colleen, let me be clear here. Those that you just cited, the FBI director, CIA, DNI, and Panetta at the Pentagon, are they opposed to this first element about the expansion of the authorization for use of military force? I kind of doubt that.
Well, maybe a couple of them do have consciences secretly, but I agree. I don't think that's the reason that they are opposing it. I think the reason that you've seen articulated is because it curtails, or they believe it curtails, presidential discretion.
Mm-hmm.
So this is going back to that executive unitary emergency war powers. They don't want the Congress to tell them that they can't transfer somebody out of Guantanamo if they want to, or that they're forced. Actually, too, this actually forces the president to use the military tribunals for all accused terrorists that are non-citizens. There's a requirement. So, of course, that would, if you think about it, that would curtail his discretion. And I think just from a precedent standpoint, they don't want to see Congress taking any, you know, stepping on any toes of the president. So that probably is the reason. Mm-hmm. Someone said it's a fight between martial law and, the all-powerful unitary executive presidential powers.
And for people who are listening to this and believe or have some doubt about closing Guantanamo, I invite you to search in the podcast at peterbcollins.com for Morris Davis. Colonel Morris Davis served at Guantanamo as the lead prosecutor, and he resigned to voice his objections to the idea that all trials had to end in a guilty verdict, and that these were rigged kangaroo courts or political show trials. And if you think that Guantanamo has an ounce of judicial integrity, I invite you to listen to Colonel Davis and read some of the things that he has published since he resigned. He spent 25 years as a judge advocate general. He is no slouch when it comes to military justice, and he stood up and really put himself on the line for true justice, not the political version that we have seen in recent years. Colleen Rowley, the third critical issue in this National Defense Authorization Act for 2012 is the expansion to cover American citizens in the United States. And this is a very serious issue of police state creep. So explain what the legislation provides, please.
Well, yeah, it distinguishes citizens only in the respect that it's permissive. The president could permissively detain citizens indefinitely, even on U.S. soil, and using the military. So there's a sneaky little phrase in there, and a lot of comments, on my Huffington Post said, "Well, it's not required." Well, it's not required, but it's permissive. And then again, that's why Feinstein brought up this vote and asked, "Well, let's make it explicit. Let's stop the worry here that this applies to American citizens." And the vote failed.
And so, let's talk a moment, because I've known Dianne Feinstein since she was mayor of San Francisco in the 1970s. And while I respect her service to the nation, I have many disagreements with her on policy issues, and particularly since she went on the Intelligence Committee, which she now chairs. She has been a hardliner supporting the wiretapping and the expansion of presidential authority to monitor our communications between Americans inside the United States. She doesn't have a problem with that widespread violation of our Fourth Amendment rights. And I point this out to say how remarkable it is that a conservative, law and order, pro-power senator like Dianne Feinstein would go to the trouble of sponsoring an amendment to clarify that issue. And it has, heightened my respect for Senator Feinstein by a notch or two, because at least I feel that she is honoring the intent and the explicit meaning of the Constitution.
Yeah, except here's the thing. These senators, and there was another amendment by Mark Udall, and you can still sign a petition. It's in the bottom of my Huffington Post. And he would actually have, it seems to me at least, taken out that whole Carl Levin McCain provision, because this is all in the McCain Levin provision. So he actually was even a little broader amendment, and it failed as well. Now, here's what I don't understand. Maybe somebody can explain this. But even though these two senators led this effort to, because they saw that these things were wrong in the bill, they then still go along with it. They still are not amongst the seven. Yeah. Vote against it in the final vote.
And also the more liberal senator from California, Barbara Boxer, voted for the final bill. I'm very saddened to see that.
Yep, I think both of our Minnesota senators, Klobuchar and Al Franken, voted for it.
Yes, they did.
And so this is really troubling. It does show that this war mentality and is unless the people, and I do, that's why I, of course, quickly wrote this on Huffington, and now some other, hopefully other people will quick get out there. And I found there's a White House petition just recently you can sign. It's got about 2,000 signatures so far. That's incredible. A country of 300 million, we're on the verge of reversing 133 years of posse comitatus that the military is not supposed to be used domestically. Completely, you know, basically looking at the military rule taking over from civilian rule of our government, and only 2,000 people have signed the White House petition for Obama to veto this really problematic law.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it's largely, though, because the media has failed, other than, like I said, a few, my Huffington Post, a few blogs out there. I will also signal that Ray McGovern wrote a good piece on consortium.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his piece was good because this is an actual true story. He had the chance this week to be in an audience with Rick Perry. And because Ray McGovern was on the Gaza Audacity of Hope, one of the Gaza flotilla boats.
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm.
When Rick Perry wrote a letter to Eric Holder saying that they all should be treated as terrorists for trying to break Israel's blockade and be prosecuted. And McGovern's question of him, you know, live question to him, which kind of didn't really throw Perry too much. I'll tell you what his answer was. He goes, what law would we have been prosecuted under? Because our State Department has not said that this blockade is even legal. And, of course, Perry wasn't stumped, and all his answer back was, well, I support Israel no matter what. That was his very, you know, he really didn't answer the question. But if he became president, and, you know, there are certainly probably many others out there, you can just imagine who they could point fingers at, especially if it includes American citizens. Anybody at all that disagrees with their policies, they could point a finger at, accuse them of being a terrorist, and they would be just like in the Stasis or in the Soviet Union or in all of those countries that we so long looked at and criticized as being totalitarian. And now we're looking at the same thing, and I do hope more people pay attention to this.
And Colleen, there are many people who say, well, why should I worry about this? It wouldn't happen here. And if they single somebody out, it'll be because that person really deserves it. But we have seen case after case of people held without charge and ultimately released because there was no case to bring against them. After 9/11, thousands of people were held. And as we'll discuss in the second segment, Susan Lindauer is an unusual case, but she was detained at an Air Force base where they said they were evaluating her psychological balance. But it was based on an order from a judge in New York. But it's a very troubling case, and it just shows us this is a woman who is related to Andy Card, who was the White House chief of staff at the time. Maybe that's one reason she got the special treatment. I can't tell. But we know that this has happened already to American citizens in the United States, and this will regularize it and really allow the excesses of the Patriot Act and the other power grabs that have occurred since 9/11
to become permanent.
To
be clear on the Patriot Act is really broad, and a lot of it is almost non-relevant. There's one part that's very relevant, one out of 264 provisions that's relevant to what we're talking about, and it's the expansion of quote-unquote material support to terrorism that now the Supreme Court has interpreted to be advocacy. It could even be hiring a lawyer to defend yourself, and it can be humanitarian aid. And so there's no limits on that right now. The Supreme Court just made it wide open. So this is, then if you look at the history of our last decade, the first roundup of those 1,000 immigrants that were put in jail, some beat up, none of them proved to have a connection to terrorism. There were commentators saying this is the time to take off the gloves because those people we have in jail, you know, this is October 2001, they're not talking. Now you can just see the silliness, ridiculousness of torturing people to try to get information out of them when they're completely innocent. I mean, this is, you know, the witch hunt that we, you know, witch hunt on steroids. Then, of course, you go from the Roundup after 9/11, and you go to Guantanamo. Guantanamo has, I think they found at least a couple hundred that were totally innocent because bounties were paid for them. So the problem with tipping the criminal justice system on its head and saying you don't need proof, you don't need evidence, you don't need a process, any kind of a due process where any amount of evidence is weighed, where a jury or a judge looks at it, that's what we're saying here. We're saying that we don't need that stuff, that we'll just completely trust Lindsey Graham or somebody like that to point to you and say you're a terrorist.
Well, Colleen, the numbers at Guantanamo are a little bit steeper than what you described. A total of 775, plus or minus a couple, were held at one time or another. And over 600 of those men were released without any charge.
Yeah.
And it shows that this was a dragnet fueled by American cash. As you mentioned, many of them were sold into bounty, many to settle scores because they had crossed the Haqqani network or some of the other warlords that we were leasing in Afghanistan. And so it's really a travesty, and that's what Morris Davis, who is one of those reluctant whistleblowers, has really performed a great service in pointing out not only that innocent people were held there for year after year without charge or trial, but that the system is rigged, and that Colonel Hartman and guy who's now at Chevron, who was the attorney, the chief counsel at the Pentagon under Rumsfeld, he very explicitly said there can be no acquittals at these kangaroo court trials in Guantanamo. So this is from now, from beginning to end, a process that is legally bankrupt when it's taken to its extremes.
And if there's one point I can make, it's that this is not, it is about ethics and right and wrong, and it is about the legalities and the what's illegal and not legal, but it's worse than that. This is completely a hoax, in other words. This is a show. They're trying to give a false sense of security. Actually, the Roundup was all for that reason, you know, to tell people you had 1,000 people in custody, and everybody breathed a sigh of relief. Oh, thank goodness, they're on top of it. They're doing something. Mm-hmm. Well, if none of the people in custody are connected to terrorism, what you've done is you've made the situation worse. You have not made it better. You have not accomplished anything. So I always talk about the very pragmatic aspect here, which is that these things don't work. It does not work to put innocent people in jail. Does that accomplish anything, or does it actually increase terrorism? And ultimately, all of these things that, you know, impact innocent civilians are going to radicalize. And, of course, the rest of the world, forget about it. They see Guantanamo, and we can't even go out to a country that does have human rights abuse and tell them to stop doing what they're doing, because they're going to say, look at you. You know, look at the United States. If you think you have freedom and democracy, and here you have this. And now we're saying we're going to continue.
Well, it is hypocritical, but it doesn't stop us from, offering a double standard.
We've given a green light to the rest of the world to even expand what they're doing.
Indeed. You also cite in your article the critical case surfaced in Chicago and Minneapolis a year ago September, and we've covered that here on this program. 23 American citizens were subjected to raids where the FBI came and took their computers and their materials. And these are peace activists who had been working to broker understanding, I believe, with the FARC and the government in Colombia, and also on Palestinian issues. And they were found to, or at least it was suspected, that they were in violation of this material support clause because they were trying to get warring factions to come together for peace talks. So in order to contact somebody to get them to come to a peace talk, that was construed as material support for an organization that was on a terrorist watch list. And it just shows how slippery the slopes are, and that this is already happening what this new defense authorization bill does is enshrine it in a stronger legal package. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's exactly. A lot of this has been happening de facto. The 23 anti-war activists have not yet been charged. They're still under investigation. And, of course, I would guess that maybe they'll never even be told, even if there's no evidence developed. I kind of doubt that the government will tell them that, you know, we've decided not to prosecute you. I think they'll just let it go on because they don't care about individuals. They, you know, from their standpoint, this war on terror is all about PR. And obviously, if they did make a mistake, but it's also quite possible that some of them will be charged, and simply because this law in the Patriot Act, this provision is so broad. Mm-hmm. You can even give used clothing, and you don't even know where it's going to go because there's no intent required. You don't have to intend to materially support a terrorist group, which is incredible. That was Russ Feingold's remedy to the laws. He said, well, at the very least, you have to prove that you have to intend this, that you just give a used pair of shoes and it ends up in Gaza or something, and you didn't know it was going to go to somebody, and that you could now be accused of terrorism.
Well, and of course, you send shoes to Iraq, somebody might throw them at a president of the United States when he visits.
yeah, there. Oh, my goodness. That would definitely be.
Well, but I raise that because that's the only way that shoes could be construed as some sort of a weapon or even a dual-use item under the sanction laws that are passed to try to prevent military supplies from reaching a nation that is under sanctions. But this stuff takes on a tragic and comic nature when you try to put it into a rational frame.
Yeah, it's very important for people to read up on this right now. If you Google National Defense Authorization Act, and the other person who's written a lot about it is a good article on Mother Jones. And then there's also a law professor that I quoted, and he's got a much longer article. I just excerpted him, Stephen Vladek at American mm-hmm. University, national security law professor. And then also Glenn Greenwald on Salon. All good articles, and I would suggest people read this, and then please call your Aunt Lucy, call your cousins, and get everybody to call Obama. I'm just going to go out on a limb and venture a guess. The one part of this is so problematic that it could be, it certainly is susceptible and could be used to detain American citizens. I'm going to guess that maybe they will take that part out. Of course, it's still terrible, even if they were to clarify that it didn't include American citizens, because it does extend the authorization to use military force. It keeps Guantanamo open indefinitely. So people should say in the strongest terms to their senators, like the ones, especially if they were the ones who voted the 93, that they expect that they should stand up if Obama does veto this and not vote now to override the veto.
Indeed, and there you should also go to whitehouse.gov where you can sign on to a petition. It's a shame that after, 5 days, only 2,000 people have signed that, so let's get some activity going there as well. Colleen, do you happen to have a list of the 7 senators who voted against the ultimate bill, the final bill?
Well, I know Rand Paul. I think it was, I'll say, I can name a few of them. Rand Paul and Coburn, Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It was real bipartisan.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the 93 were bipartisan, too, which tells you something, that there's hardly a hair's whiskers difference between these parties when it comes to war. But then the 7 were also a mixture of Republicans and Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, Colleen, before you go, I wanted to ask you about one other related aspect. We have related several times here that the director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, has advised the president to veto this bill. And I just wanted to ask your thoughts about the extension of his term, because some people might have a renewed appreciation for the length of time that J. Edgar Hoover served and the damage that he did as FBI director from the new movie called J. Edgar. But that movie really didn't delve into the true damage that Hoover did, and I was disappointed by it in that respect. Still, many people do know how Hoover created COINTELPRO. He kept information on elected officials so he could blackmail them. He was extremely powerful, and one of the post-Watergate reforms was to limit the FBI director to a single 10-year term. But this year, the Obama administration apparently feared a confirmation battle of appointing a replacement, and so they quietly extended his term by 2 years. And I'm really pissed off about that because, this is one of the lessons we were supposed to have learned from Watergate. And it's just another case of the Democrats serving up one of those reforms and just giving up on it. And I've got a lot of criticism of Mueller. I'll limit it right now to the abuse of the Patriot Act and the national security letters, which is a very open and public issue. They have widely abused the expanded authority that was given to the FBI after 9/11. And yet the man who is at the helm has been given 2 more years to abuse us.
Well, I'll play devil's advocate, and while I agree with you that Robert Mueller has almost now, in the war on terror, he's almost repeating COINTELPRO. He's almost picking up from the 60s, Hoover's last years, when, again, Hoover had become so paranoid about communism and had ordered wiretapping of Martin Luther King and Vietnam protesters and whatever. And you can see that era now being repeated. I will say this, though, for Robert Mueller. If he was to be replaced, I really doubt we'd have anyone better. In fact, given the politics, and you look out there, every time, especially under Bush, of course, with replacing Ashcroft.
with Gonzalez, Mukasey, with Mukasey.
And then Mukasey, or no, it was Ashcroft, and then you got Gonzalez, and
right.
Then Gonzalez to Mukasey.
Yeah.
And they were one was worse than the other. And, that, of course, they were short terms, actually, relatively short terms. So the numbers of years is kind of irrelevant. They will not appoint anyone with integrity to any of these positions. They are going to appoint someone that is a complete sycophant. And that's probably the worst character flaw of Robert Mueller's. He's just gone along with this completely. When he started, he gave speeches to the ACLU and got applause because he said we would maintain civil liberties. And you watch this, the what happens in 10 years, and by the end of the thing, he's completely, the whole pendulum has gone over. And, of course, he knows this. He can't be this dumb. He knows that he's betrayed what he promised, but he feels he's in this really bad system, of course, and so he just goes along with it.
Well, Colleen, I accept your advocacy of El Diablo.
It's weak advocacy, by the way.
Well, no, you're correct that changing the players might not have had major impact, and certainly we might have seen a nomination that was worse than Mueller. I simply feel that there should have been open and honest debate about extending his term. This is like holding over Bloomberg in New York for a third term.
Right.
And well, I just think that we have to stand by the process. And I'm as annoyed that Mueller got an extra 2 years as I am by the manner in which it was handled.
Yeah, the debate's everything. And so you're absolutely right. If the term would have expired and it would have been firm, we would have had a way to air this in the media. So it would have been a way to get more of this information out. So you're absolutely right about that.
And I think the Obama administration, since they have failed to prosecute the wrongdoing that occurred under Bush, that they didn't want any more focus on the FBI.
Oh.
They didn't want a confirmation hearing where the lousy record of prosecuting Wall Street criminals would have been exposed and
right.
You know, brought into the headlines. And
right.
And so this all around is an exercise in political cowardice.
Absolutely. And the tragedy is if Robert Mueller, if we do go to the use of the military, domestically, that undermines the criminal justice system, and it actually undermines the FBI, because now the military will have a much larger role. So here, after all of this, he's presiding over a lesser role for the FBI.
Well, Colleen, thank you for the 24 years that you devoted to the FBI and the standards that you continue to uphold.
Thank you.
Colleen Rowley here on the Peter B. Collins Show.
You must be a prisoner in disguise.
U.S. government would never detain an American citizen and deny him or her their constitutional rights, or would they? Or has it happened already? To answer that question, I've invited Susan Lindauer to join us. She was on our program a little over a year ago when she published her book, Extreme Prejudice, the terrifying story of the Patriot Act and the cover-ups of 9/11 and Iraq. Susan, thanks for joining us today.
I'm so frightened of what's happening in this country, but I have already lived through this, Peter.
Well, and that's why I wanted you to share your story. But before you do, tell me what your reaction was on Thursday, December 1st, when the Senate approved this new defense appropriation bill that includes the very troubling language that extends the authorization for the use of military force, turns a blank check into the blankest of all checks ever, that U.S. citizens can be detained without charge or trial, essentially gitmoized for alleged terrorist offenses. And the law essentially forces the president's hand and requires that Gitmo stay open indefinitely and that only the Defense Department can handle non-citizen terrorist suspects in the future. What was your reaction to this bill?
I'm appalled to see who has been willing to throw out the constitutional rights of American citizens. Nobody should be placated that they're saying that only terrorists need to be worried about this, that anyone who's not involved in violent activities should be worried. In fact, I was the second non-Arab American ever indicted on the Patriot Act, and I was held in prison on a Texas military base for a year without a trial or a hearing. I begged for a hearing. I repeatedly pleaded for my rights to due process. The government responded took advantage of my forced silence to invent a story that I was a religious maniac, that I suffered from religious delusions, which was just the most bizarre thing. If everyone who knows me, I do believe in God. I have a kind of I hope I have a spiritual life, but I am no Sarah Palin or Michelle Bachman. I'm bewildered by this. No one would think that. But what happens when you take away due process and you take away the rights to present your own side of the events and to dispute the charges is you are destroyed. Your reputation, your identity is destroyed, and the government paints a picture of you that you have no capability to obliterate, to attack.
And Susan, let me offer as a most recent example, and one that I consider egregious, an American citizen living in Yemen named Anwar al-Awlaki was summarily executed by an American drone strike, even though he has never been even formally accused, much less charged or tried in absentia, for his alleged complicity with al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula. And as you just suggested, they've created a story about him that is acceptable to most Americans, who just say, well, he was a bad guy, we killed him. End of story, don't trouble me with the details, don't bother me with this constitutional stuff, because he was a bad guy and Obama took him out. And I view this as an indicator of this slippery slope. And because there was so little reaction to the execution of al-Awlaki, now the Senate steps up and hardens the police state that's in formation in this country through these three very troubling provisions in a defense bill that has to pass because it's what's paying for the war in Afghanistan.
Well, now, and I want to comment on this because I was locked up on a military base, in a civilian prison. Carswell Federal Medical Center is where all of the political women prisoners are being held. What it means is that you're locked inside a military base. Even though you're in a civilian prison, the military controls who is allowed to enter the base to visit you. For example, I was prohibited from having family visits. I was on three occasions The military did successfully stop me from receiving attorney visits.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle, who was an attorney who actually fit into both categories, was prohibited from entering the base even after he drove 700 miles in each direction to see me.
Mm-hmm.
And the military just flat out said, "You're not coming in here." And we had to go to Michael Mukasey, who later became U.S. Attorney General, and they had to have U.S. Marshals standing by, literally standing next to my uncle as he came onto the base, to force the military to allow this attorney visit to occur. This was happening at a crucial time when we were trying to negotiate an end to my incarceration. I was trying to get out of prison.
Right.
They had already detained me beyond my release date. The Justice Department said, "We will not let her go," even though the law said that they were only allowed to hold me for 120 days. The Justice Department, once they got me, they said, we don't care what the law says. We refuse to release this woman." And so the judge was saying, "Well, how are we going to get her out if the Justice Department won't let her go?" And I said, "Well, let's have a hearing." They said, "Oh, you can't have a hearing. Oh, no, this is the Patriot Act.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to have a hearing."
Well, and
I mean,
Susan,
this is really scary stuff. And I want other people to know, if you're locked in a military base, they control if you're allowed to write letters to your family,
mm-hmm.
if you're allowed to have phone conversations to your family, if you're allowed to watch television, what kind of prison experience you're going to have. You could be locked in solitary confinement without a trial or a hearing, and on the Patriot Act, and all these laws go together. You're not allowed to know what you're charged with, and this is true under this law, too. They are not required to tell you what your charges are.
Right.
They're not required to show any evidence that you broke the law that they're accusing you of breaking. They're not required to even—since you're not allowed to have a hearing, you're not even allowed the chance to challenge the allegations against you or to disprove the allegations against you. In my case, I was held under indictment for 5 years. We were never allowed to know who had accused me of the crimes. I was not allowed to know the names of my accusers. I was never allowed to confront them. So these are political people. They're powerful people. I am not powerful. Therefore, their word, they have the right to be under the law, under these current laws. They have the right to be protected from identifying themselves and exposing how ludicrous their accusations really are. As it turned out, I had written a very friendly, beautiful, nice letter to two people that two people got: Andrew Card, who was the chief of staff to George Bush, who happened to be my cousin,
mm-hmm.
and Colin Powell, who was the Secretary of State. And Colin Powell had received the copies of my Andy Card letters. These were very positive, friendly, non-threatening, non-hostile letters. You don't ever threaten a member of the White House, ever.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do that. It's
and Susan,
and it's stupid.
Susan,
you're not going to get what you want.
Susan, let's thumbnail for listeners who aren't familiar with the previous interview that we did. You were working as a CIA asset. You were essentially handling back-channel communications with Iraq and third-party countries prior to our invasion in 2003. And when the Bush administration offered its rationalization for the invasion, the weapons of mass destruction, Saddam's failure to relent on those issues, you were so infuriated that you wanted to go public. And you wanted to make the public aware, and even administration officials, of what the truth was. And so I just want people to understand that your quote-unquote crimes had nothing to do with support of an enemy, nothing to do with so-called material support, however that's defined, of a terrorist group or a terrorist organization. And you were locked up because you had information that was embarrassing to top Bush administration officials.
That is absolutely correct. I had worked against terrorism for a decade. I had been on the cutting edge of anti-terrorism. I had given advance warnings about 9/11, which is a whole other ball game. And I had covered Iraq's cooperation with the 9/11 investigation and the fact that Iraq was willing to allow the FBI to go into Baghdad. They wanted to give us financial documents on Al-Qaeda. This was really great, meaty stuff. I had somebody inside Baghdad, high-level Mukhabarat agent, who was going to identify terrorists moving around the country, who had entered the country, when, where they were staying, who they were meeting with, activities, and they would have been liaisoning with the FBI. We had a whole structure for how to execute anti-terrorism in Iraq that required no military action at all and would have really achieved some really, if you believe in anti-terrorism, would have achieved actual results. You have the thing about the Bush administration, the Republican policy has achieved nothing. You've actually created terrorism where there was none, and you've thousands of people have died, on millions of people in Iraq. It's ridiculous. It's horrible. It's terrible. And I was arrested 30 days after I contacted John McCain and Trent Lott, requesting to testify on Capitol Hill. And so here I had dedicated my whole life to anti-terrorism, my whole career, and I had requested permission to testify. So think of Bradley Manning, who went to WikiLeaks. And then think of me, and I went through normal channels, and I requested permission to do it properly. And both of us end up in prison, because these things are not about security. They're about protecting politicians who don't want to face the people. They want to lie to you. They are lying to you. They are deceiving you. They're exaggerating their own importance in anti-terrorism. These guys are doing a terrible job in anti-terrorism. They're not providing oversight. They're not providing the budgeting that they're talking about. They're not watching the money. My own CIA handler stole $13 million off the 9/11 investigation, and do you know that not one member of the Senate has ever been willing to investigate it? They don't care. The only thing that mattered was that Richard Fuse was willing to hide the facts about 9/11 and the fact that we knew about 9/11 before it happened. And so as long as he was willing to do that, he could pocket that $13 million tax-free. No one would touch him.
Susan Lindauer, what is your reaction when you see people who are nominally liberals, Patrick Leahy, Carl Levin, senator from Michigan, propose and/or support these draconian moves that really directly conflict with our constitutional rights? What's wrong with them?
What is wrong with them? I am heartbroken. I'm horrified. It's chilling. I am baffled. How could anybody who believes in the freedom of this country, who's a Democrat, much less, these are anti-war, these are people who've portrayed themselves as being anti-war people. They're, or I don't know, maybe that's not fair, but they certainly have been questioning the Bush policies.
Yeah, they oppose the Bush policies, but when Obama is in the White House, here they are rushing this legislation through as if they're concerned that when Republicans presumably take control of the Senate in the elections next year, they won't be able to pass it. I mean, what's the rush? Why are they doing this in such an underhanded way without public debate? And they haven't made the case that the government needs these kinds of tactics and legal standards or lowered legal standards to protect
us. There is a case. If you believe in fascism, if you believe in martial law, if you are looking at the Occupy Wall Street movement and you believe that free speech qualifies as sedition, and sedition, which means challenging the government and institutions of authority, institutions that quote unquote stabilize our economic future, like the Wall Street movement, mm-hmm. then you're looking at these people and you are afraid, because these people are who I love Occupy Wall Street. Don't you ever back down. But the government is definitely taking a side on behalf of the corporations, and the corporations are personhood, and people are not persons, and we don't get the constitutional rights of a corporation. But we need to be worried, because a lot of people believe that this is only going to affect terrorists who are engaged in violent conspiracies. You are completely wrong about that. It is free speech, free thinking, questioning the government. The natural outcome of questioning a vulnerable government is that they believe they're going to be overthrown. And they believe that we're going to challenge them, they will not be able to sustain themselves against us, and they see it as us versus them. I guarantee it. That's what's going on.
Susan, I've been a longtime critic of Senator Feinstein, my senior senator from California, because she votes with the Republicans and during the Bush era supported virtually all of the extreme measures that Bush asked for and the Congress gave him. And so I was surprised, and pleasantly so, that Senator Feinstein was so concerned about the language in this bill that she offered an amendment to clarify that it did not apply to American citizens. But her amendment was defeated. She only had 45 votes in support of it in the United States Senate. And that is stunning when someone as conservative and pro-government power as Dianne Feinstein feels the need to clarify this, and 55 of her colleagues say, never mind. That in itself is really troubling.
Well, I want you to know something that I cannot claim to credit all credit for this, and maybe only a partial pinprick. I have been up on Capitol Hill for the past month campaigning, raising. I took copies of my book, Extreme Prejudice, to Capitol Hill, and just about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And I took it to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and I bombarded Dianne Feinstein's office with emails and protests about how could you allow this to happen to an American citizen, that the Patriot Act has been misrepresented as only applying to foreigners, and that people have the wrong idea that terrorism of what types of activities are going to be subjected to this stuff, and why didn't Dianne Feinstein stand up for America? So I kind of got ahead of everybody on this one, and maybe something pricked her a little bit, but this is a woman who has been who for years has been willing to tolerate all sorts of abuses of American citizens.
And let me give you one example. Mark Klein was working for AT&T in San Francisco when they installed the switch that diverts all of our emails and phone calls to the National Security Administration for interception and monitoring. And he first went to his United States Senators, Boxer and Feinstein. Didn't get very far with Boxer. Took a meeting with a Feinstein assistant who then shared the information with the senator. And you know what she did? She turned it over to the CIA and the NSA.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
So that shows the complicity of Dianne Feinstein in protecting the national security state. And once again, it underscores what a change, what a deviation this is for her. And Susan, I'm happy to give you more than a pinprick's worth of credit. Thank you for lobbying on Capitol Hill. Thank you for anything you did to open Dianne Feinstein's eyes.
Well, I've been pounding these guys for several weeks now. In fact, pounding is a hard word. I've been like bombarding them with emails and letters and such. Challenging the Democrats to do something different than the Republicans. But obviously, it didn't work because they still went forward with a law like this.
Yeah.
So I can only say that it only got you so far. I have a beautiful quote by H.L. Mencken that I want to share with you.
Go ahead.
The most dangerous man to any government is the man who is able to think things out for himself. Almost inevitably, he comes to the conclusion that the government he lives under is dishonest, insane, and intolerable.
Amen.
And I like that. That's H.L. Mencken.
Now, let me get your reaction to this. I get emails from all over the place, and some of them come from unusual right-wing outlets. Pete Hoekstra is a congressman, Republican from Michigan, who is the former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. He is running against Democrat Debbie Stabenow for the Senate seat that is up this year in Michigan. And under these circumstances, Stabenow probably felt compelled to vote for this Defense Authorization Act to avoid giving her opponent any opportunity to say she's soft on terrorism. So Stabenow votes for it. Hoekstra issues this statement. By passing the National Defense Authorization Act, Debbie Stabenow and her colleagues in the Senate have ignored the constitutional rights of American citizens. Now, get this, as he
He's
splits.
Right.
Okay, but wait. Wait till you hear what
right.
he says. I do not oppose the indefinite detainment of U.S. citizens who have sought to bring harm to America and been identified as terrorists. What I do oppose is allowing the military to do so without due process, as this permits. Now, I think this is really intriguing because Hoekstra is right about what he's opposing. But he feels compelled to say, I don't oppose the indefinite detainment. Detainment isn't even a word. Detention of U.S. citizens who've sought to bring harm to America, and he says, who have been identified as terrorists. He doesn't say charged. He doesn't say anything is proven. He doesn't say they've been convicted. He just says that he's trying to win a political point against his Democratic opponent by pointing out the obvious that you and I agree with, that this is unconstitutional. But meanwhile, he wants to give away just half of the constitutional rights in this particular basket.
Well, there is a very important question of whether the military should be arresting American citizens. And the difference between military control of these defendants or civilian control is huge when you're actually the defendant, because the rights of, like I said, I was detained indefinitely, and it was only because of, let me be clear, I was indicted on the Patriot Act, I was detained indefinitely, and I was able to go into court. They refused to give me a trial or a hearing, but because I had a civilian judge, we could challenge the indefinite part of it, okay? The prosecution was fighting tooth and nail, refused to let me go, fought desperately to refuse to let me go, tried to have me forcibly drugged to cure me of a fantasy psychosis, which was that I was a religious maniac, which is just bizarre, and it was really intended to destroy, chemically lobotomize me so that I would be incapacitated from discussing the real facts about 9/11 and Iraqi pre-war intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be, my mind and my thinking and my functionality would be ruined and destroyed. So I have been through this, and the civilian part of it was the only thing that helped me escape. It was the only thing that we were able to leverage to stop this from becoming a true life sentence, because they would never have let me go.
Mm-hmm.
I would still be in prison today. I have no doubt about it.
Yeah.
I hear this law and I'm just scared to death, because in our last interview, we talked about Michael Mukasey and how you thought that it was, so you were kind of amused that there was like the Stockholm syndrome where I lavishly praised Michael Mukasey.
Mm-hmm.
But that was because of the civilian control. And even though I was never allowed to have a hearing, the fact that I had a civilian judge who I could petition, my uncle could petition, and realize I had to have a family member do this. My public defender was so weak, so inadequate, so mediocre, that I had to have a family member step in. How many defendants have that capability?
Mm-hmm.
They don't.
Yeah.
We had, my uncle has a degree from University of Chicago Law School. And not many people can say that their family members are. I mean, I had fellow inmates who were just like, wow, I wish we had, mm-hmm. I wish I had somebody who could do this for me. And I was very lucky. But we fought for that. It was a 5-year battle. And once I got out, they continuously tried to put me back in. Every month I would go. 2 weeks after my release, I met my new attorney, wonderful, outstanding Brian Shaughnessy, swims with the sharks in the most difficult, complicated international criminal cases, former federal prosecutor. We'd go to New York every month, and he would say, Susan, I don't know if you're going to come back or not. He said, just brace yourself. They may take you into custody. They fought and fought and fought to take me in. And it was extraordinary. The battle for my freedom only ended when John McCain lost the presidential election.
That's right.
Two weeks before before that election, my attorney Brian Shaughnessy got a phone call from the U.S. Marshals saying they were going to take me, And Brian's, again, he called me up. He says, Susan, just be ready. Try to be graceful. Try to remember that if they show up, don't scream. Don't resist arrest. Just go graciously, and we'll do everything we can to get you out. But that's the threat level that I was under. And if John McCain had won, they would have taken me in. They would have. They wanted this so badly to shut me up.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is not about terrorism. For all of you people out there who are thinking this is about violent activity, it has nothing to do with it. You are a threat to the government if you have knowledge, if you are challenging their policies, if you're criticizing them. These are very weak leaders who do not have a sense of they're not stand. They know they're not standing on a strong foundation of support for the country. And I expect us to go into a situation of martial law.
Well, Susan, I want to underscore what you just said. I think it's very important to note that, because the average American sits back and thinks that this is about violent terrorists and that we need these new laws. But there are plenty of laws on the books already. We've convicted tens of terrorists in recent years in federal court using a constitutional process. And
right.
some of those cases I have problems with because of paid FBI informants and things that I think are entrapment. But the system does work. At least if the right charges are brought and an honest prosecution occurs.
Absolutely, it works. Listen, if you have a terrorist suspect, you can get a search warrant from a judge. You don't need to go breaking into their houses without a search warrant. You can get a search warrant. If you need a wiretap, you don't have to go to a secret tribunal to get a wiretap. If you've got a real terrorist suspect, any judge will give you one. I mean, we never had difficulty with these cases. The thing is, you want these cases to be strong. Any criminal case, you only want to get the people who did it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like if you had a serial killer, why would you want to get the wrong man? Because if you get the wrong man, the guy who did it is still on the street. That wouldn't do anybody any good.
Susan, I'm going to link in the show file at peterbcollins.com to Colleen Rowley's article, and in it at the very end are two links, one to the White House petition page where you can sign on and object to this bill and encourage the president to live up to his threat to veto it, and Senator Mark Udall also has a petition. So those hot links will be available at peterbcollins.com. Do you have any...
Senator Mark Udall come out against this? Senator Mark Udall is also somebody I've been peppering with emails. There have been a few people on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and Mark Udall is one of them, who I've been begging that this was that these kind of abuses of American citizens. I outlined all the terrible things that I suffered. So if this is, I'm feeling a little bit better about this. I've been so upset I can't even tell you.
Mm-hmm.
My poor little dogs have been hiding from me for several days because I'm stomping around my living room and my kitchen, pounding things.
Yeah. Well, Susan, aside from those two petitions, where should my listeners direct their activism to get this bill vetoed?
Call the White House hotline.
Okay.
And you must do that. And you'll need to get the link for that.
It's area code. I know the number by heart. It's area code 202-456-1212. That's the main switchboard number at the White House. 202-456-1212. Well,
tell Obama that we're going to hold him responsible for this. Tell him that we don't want, you know, when we elected for change, we did not want to see this kind of thing happening to our country. We value the freedom of our country. We value the constitutional protections and the diversity of our country. And there's no threat that would require this sort of action.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing going on. The Occupy Wall Street movement does not justify throwing people in prison on military bases for indefinite detention.
Well, Susan, after what you've been through, I wouldn't be surprised if you just want to hunker down and stay out of the limelight.
No way. I'm in. I'm going to be fighting this right through Election Day. The next 12 months, here's what I want to tell everybody. Speak out. Do not let them intimidate you. Do not act in self-censorship. They want to frighten you. They want you to back down because that's how they can dominate you. But we have every 2 years, and this coming 2012 election is critical. We have an opportunity to throw out everybody who's been doing these terrible things. And we've got to clean house. We've got to cut deep, because we have some very ugly people who are in Congress right now. And we need to throw out all the incumbents. We've got to get rid of them.
The book is Extreme Prejudice. You can find it at Amazon.com. We've been talking with Susan Lindauer. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Call the White House right now, will you? And go on Facebook and tell your friends to do it, too. I'll be much obliged. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.